I don't even know how to turn that off.
Thanks, Don and Wendy. Can you hear me? Yeah, a friend last night in the hotel lobby said, ordered me or advised me not to use the words dialectical or metadata in the presentation today. So I was going to say tired tropes, but Don beat me to it, talking about the Your Name Here story. Thank you all for coming. I'm tremendously appreciative of all of your efforts with the book. And one of the interesting things about working with a book is contact with a lot of people that I hadn't previously had the chance to work with. I'd like to do the without the Academy Awards type thanks here. It will take a bit longer than 5 seconds, but I think it's important to recognize people that have helped. Our funder is the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, who's funded this new initiative, I think, and it's very visionary of them. At the National Film Preservation Foundation, I'd like to thank Annette Melville, who's really shaping this book, I think, into something that's going to be a major, thoroughly researched and high-quality resource. David Wells, who's designed the interim document you've seen, is going to do a lot more. Rebecca Payne Collins and Jeff Lambert. Our project team, some of whom you'll be hearing from today. Margie Compton, whose assistance over the years has been, hard to quantify. That's been so great and really, really tremendous. Don Crafton, sounded like a David Lodge novel today. It was quite wonderful. Thank you. Amy Gallick, Mike Michon, Wendy Shea, Abby Smith, who's not here today, and of course Dan Strebel. Our able team of advisors, Jenny Horn, Stephen Lubar, Charlie McGovern, Catherine Ott, and Greg Waller, who we'll be hearing from Jenny and Greg a little bit later. Special thanks to Scott Simon, who's helping to fill in where I don't, in the area of silent film. I'm the first person to admit I'm not a silent film scholar. And I'd like to also sort of single out for thanks our intern from last summer and this coming summer, Alex Timmons. Alex built a database of over 1,000 potential candidates for the book, plowing through a lot of literature that's not really been plowed through before. Some of it's paraliterature, some of it's highly obscure periodicals, and in fact, some of his words and his descriptions have made it into the draft. There are many others here, and you've already helped a great deal, and I'm going to continue to ask you for your thoughts, so thanks. I wanted to get that out of the way. One or two sentences on why a field guide. I don't want to repeat or preempt what's in the preface that you've had sent to you, but the notion is that here we have this universe of films. Nobody really knows how many, but it's in the hundreds of thousands. We don't have a roadmap. There are many, many worthy and neglected titles. There are many new directions for scholarship. And in fact, that's sort of the intention of my presentation today, to point out a bunch of directions that I think could be quite interesting, most of which have hardly been explored, to restore these films, which I think many of us value tremendously, foreground them. In film history and culture, and also in the broad history and culture, so that we're not simply, these aren't simple floating artifacts that we relate to in sort of a campy way. And finally, to help develop preservation priorities. We need to really find a way to make sure that important works of merit in this sort of galaxy of genres need to be preserved, and so this is a first step. The title of this talk is called An Illustrated Overview of Sponsored Film. This is very difficult. It's hard to present this in a systematic fashion. Until recently, this field has been a fairly empty slate onto which the few investigators have sort of had to project their own ideas. This has changed, and it's tremendously gratifying, but there's a lot more to do. So what I'm going to show is sort of an anthology within this little 40-minute pod of a bunch of segments that represent different genres, although that's a word I'm extremely reluctant to use yet, or clusters. aggregations of sponsored films. So I've selected 14 clips that exemplify some of these types, indicate boundaries. Genres are provisional. Borders are going to have to be provisional. There's much that remains to be discovered. Every one of these films, I think, has significant evidentiary value. That's kind of been my big bug over the last years, evidentiary value. So please, issues that are raised today, go to the draft of the book, look through it. Please let us know your thoughts. They'd be very much appreciated. We're going to begin with a couple of silent-sponsored films. The first is an advertising film. It's called The Home Electrical. It was made by General Electric in 1915 to show a concept home that's accessorized with every possible appliances. There are no gas appliances in that world. This was an in-house production. We think it was tied in with the adequate wiring campaigns of the teens in the 20s. Adequate wiring really means adequate consumption of electricity, of course. Katie, could you hit play? This is about a minute and a half, 2 minutes of a one-reel silent film. The didactic naming of characters is really common in this period, of course. Um, 1915, according to an article written in Ed Screen by the man who supposedly produced this. That's not completely authenticated, though. This film was distributed as a historical piece by General Electric really up until the time of footage 89, so that's been around. He's having an ecstatic moment. So if you could pause on the black, Katie, that'd be swell. The next clip is from a newsreel called the Detroit News Pictorial, issued around 1917. Newspapers in many, many cities sponsored films, and this is something that's not well documented. I think many of you have seen the Oakland Tribune American theater chain Dream film, where they had a contest for the best dream every year. This is one from about 1917. This is not a Jam Handy film, as far as I know, but he got his start with the Keeley Handy Syndicate, producing films for and acquiring films for syndicated distribution around the country in sort of a multimedia deal. The idea was to coordinate films with stories and reach the post-literate audience of the day, which sounds like people are doing today. The Keeley Handy Syndicate morphed into the Newspapers Film Corporation, which became the Jam Handy Organization. And I have just discovered the Jam Handy papers in the Detroit Public Library, which I highly recommend. They're absolutely fascinating. I spent a day with them, and I'm now booked to go back for like a week. Let's roll Detroit News Pictorial. This is a little story of transgression and repentance, and it's got some nice sort of landscape photography of Detroit streets in 1917. Thank you. Towards now that Detroit, as the city is reverting to an agrarian landscape. There's a pause here. That was, as best I know, shown in theaters in the Detroit area. It's a means of taking the newspaper brand further. This reel doesn't contain any explicit advertising, but I have a sense that there was that screen advertising was part of it. But it's without context. It came from a flea market in Detroit. Day before yesterday, General Motors announced a plan to try to buy out all of its unionized workers, well over 100,000 jobs. If that's successful, and it may not be, it's the culmination of a process that began in 1937, right after the UAW successfully organized workers in Chevrolet auto plants. After that success, which was also kind of a great reversal of the media picture of the auto industry, General Motors turned to media to try to gain an ideological edge and sort of turn the union into a marginal player. As described in a series of two articles in Harper's by Walker and Sklar called Business Finds Its Voice in 1938, which also became a book, this film, From Dawn to Sunset, was part of a regional strategy. It was not directed at the broad public. It was directed at workers, their families, and other residents of 12 cities where Chevy plants were located. The idea was to kind of reclaim the ideological high ground, to propose and describe a codependent economic relationship between workers and corporations. Larry Bird and Roland Marchand have talked about this in their books in great detail, but how do you do that? How do you characterize a codependent economic relationship? One of the ways you do that is by, rather than showing people working, showing them getting paid and showing them buying things with their paycheck. And in fact, this film is largely composed of, we won't see that part, but it's people lining up to get paid and then buying things. And in fact, there's much more running time devoted to people getting paid than to people actually working. This film was released in the late spring of 37, right after the sit-down strikes. It shows signs of hasty editing, and a lot of it is made out of pre-existing footage. You'll see that there's some gaps, some little cuts out of footage while the audio track is continuous. It begins with a Kino Eye type sequence of workers coming to work, which I think is quite beautifully shot. We see the 12 cities where Chevy is, and then we hear an inspiring song. So let's look at the beginning of From Dawn to Sunset.
Clarion call of industry sounds good morning to America's manpower. As dawn comes out of the east and spreads down the quiet streets, the clans gather in a score of cities. In thousands of homes, vigorous workmen rise to meet a new day and a new opportunity. The morning sun stirs the nation's workmen, prompting them to their posts of daily service. Follow the eastern sun as it rises on the homes of men along the great Atlantic seaboard. The morning light over the plains has waked the thousands who are off to enliven the factories of the vast Midwestern states. And along the sunny shores of the Pacific, men are on their way to quicken the beat of industry. In 12 great cities, located in every region of the country, the clans are gathering for the work of a new day. As the sun stretches fingers of light across the pavements, the early morning sparkles with the greeting of men to men. On their way to factories in Flint and Atlanta, from Tarrytown to Oakland, the neighborly workmen hail each other with the salute of fellowship. Along the roads to the factories, tens of thousands begin to mass. They swell the rising tide. Into the silent buildings flows the life stream. The great producing units of the nation's mightiest manufacturing enterprise awake. The giant assembly plants begin to stir.
Tonight, when we look at Master Hands, which is going to be a great cultural event this evening, the premiere of Restored Master Hands, I think we can begin to question the differences between modes of representation in the United States and in the Soviet Union of the period. And I'd love to see reception studies on this film, if there were any. No survey of sponsored films would be complete without talking about safety films. This is a rich and long-lived genre. It embodies many contradictions. Safety films, of course, tend to glamorize accidents. I guess Sam Orleans took an opposite in The Sixth Wheel. They were trying to reinforce healthy behavior. This is a film made by the Red Cross. If Arthur Edwin Krauss and his survey of his memoir, really, of non-theatrical production can be trusted, the Red Cross started making films in about 1910. They made many, many, many films. This is an atypical film made in 37 by the William J. Gans Company, kind of a high-budget, high-end company. What strikes me about this film is that it's highly sensational, and the footage comes, I think, from many divergent sources. Maybe some of you will be able to spot it. This is just a minute. Can we roll? This is actually a remarkably sort of brutal and sensational film. Why Not Live, it's called.
What the gambler risks is his own, and when he loses, the despair, defeat, the bitter dregs of misery are his alone. But there are those who gamble with the spinning wheel of a speeding motor car, risking not only their own lives, but the lives and happiness of others.
Or pause. That's a bit hard hitting. I couldn't do this without showing a clip of the Middleton family at the World's Fair. Now, people, many of you may be familiar with this film. It's been written about a fair amount. I don't think people have really quite written about it comprehensively. It's one of the quintessential sponsored films of the late 1930s, and in some ways it contains elements of a template that really characterizes thousands of other productions. It was made by Westinghouse to take the message of the 1939, their World's Fair Pavilion exhibit on the road. It's both an advertising and an institutional film. Institutional advertising is a specific subset of sponsored films that was meant to promote a brand, a corporation as an entity, rather than a specific product line, not so much about sales. There are no gas appliances in this film, of course. It's an example of the corporate appropriation of utopian ideas. It links patriotism and free market economics. It's got a great anti-communist thread. But what we're going to look at is the sequence showing the battle between modernism and tradition in the kitchen. So let's play.
Final desperate spurt, hitting those dishes with everything she has. She's consistently diving in the bottom of the dark and greasy water to search for knives and forks. Dishwater splashing around terrific rate all over Mrs. Drudge. That rubber apron isn't much help now. She's splashing so hard it's getting all over me. And it's a little dangerous to attempt to give a blow-by-blow account of what's going on in that dishpan. There's a lot of action over here. She's mopping up with a towel to get the water some of the dishes she dried a few minutes ago. That water in the pan is an awful messy-looking sight, folks. I wish you could see it. Incidentally, in the entire operation, the dishwasher will use a total of only 15 quarts of water, which is a lot less than Mrs. Drudge's use. And now over here, Mrs.
Drudge washes dishes just like Tom. Nonsense. Takes him an hour to wash a plate. He heated dishes. Then he usually drops when that door is open. I mean, he gets more water on the floor than on the dishes. That's why I never let him help me anymore. Now I know he's smarter than you.
Mrs. Drudge, come on, please. Hurry, Mrs. Drudge, before it's too late. That water's coming out very fast. Too late. There's the last drop of water, folks. The contest is over in exactly 7 minutes and 58 seconds. In that time, Mrs. Modern has washed 50 dishes and 40 pieces of silverware. As I... Well, it's all over, Mrs. Drudge. You may as well rest now. As I said before, ladies and gentlemen, this contest is going to be scored on three counts. First, the time it takes to do the dishes. Unquestionably, Mrs. Modern wins on that score. Second, the cleanliness of the dishes. They are clean, they are dry, and sparkling. They do honor to any woman's table, so Mrs. Modern wins point number two. Her dishes are certainly cleaner. And now, point number three. The condition of the contestants. Mrs. Modern looks as fresh and neat as when she stepped into the ring. While Mrs. Drudge, well, I'll have to leave that to you. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I give you the winner, Mrs. Modern.
It's kind of theater of cruelty there. Corporate advocacy film plays a tremendous role, and I think we could take it back quite a ways. This is a clip from a film called Our America, made by Wilding, another very high-end, high-production value company for Chrysler in 1947. It's a slickly reasoned film, and it's about, it sort of advocates government, get your hands off free enterprise. But it's attempting to garner support from the public for a laissez-faire economic policy. And the way it does that is it invokes popular disillusionment with rationing and with wartime restrictions and expresses people's relief when wartime restrictions ended. But it's a film that I think in some ways resonates with today's reality. So let's play this.
In times of national stress, we are compelled to abandon many of our hard-won privileges and prerogatives. When boards and bureaus and agencies take away parts of our liberty, we grin and bear it. But when the emergency passes, let us stoutly demand the restoration of our rights. Remember when coffee was scarce and we couldn't have a second cup? Of course we didn't like it, but the coffee shortage wasn't fatal. We lived through it. The big point is this. We gave it up to help win the war, and we got it back. So let it be with all our liberties that must be suspended when our enemies press about us, but must just as surely be restored, that the spirit of freedom shall not perish.
This is a small town newspaper editor trying to write his editorial. That's sort of the frame. It's, again, a very common frame, if you know from films like Letter to a Rebel and so on. Our next clip is from a film called Give Us This Day. It was made sometime in 1950-51 for the Oregon Wheat Growers Council. I did not have, which I regret, an early agricultural film to show today. That's an area that I know Greg Waller's been doing work on, and perhaps we can hear from him. This is an example of really thousands of films made in the middle of the century. It looks and sounds like many other agriculturally oriented films. Calvin in Kansas City made lots of films like this. This was not made. This was made by a Southern California man named Felber Mastam. It has the old-fashioned reedy organ score. It has the voiceovers that sound like they were done in a little shed. And rather mystical beauty shots of skies, land, and grain. The structure of this film is a year on a wheat farm in eastern Oregon, and expresses some confused and regrettably racist ideas about nutrition. Let's play that.
Here, where the mighty Columbia River flows from the roof of the continent, is the wheat country of eastern Oregon, the high, dry upland country, a country of mild winters and long, hot summers. This is a typical Oregon wheat ranch. It isn't large, nor is it small. 1,200 acres, about average for the Pacific Northwest. This is Floyd Root, a typical American wheat farmer. A graduate of Oregon State College, he works the same land his father and grandfather farmed before him. Bill is the eldest son. Next year, he will follow his father's footsteps to Oregon State. A wheat farmer in the making. Both combine and truck keep moving during the loading. For when the wheat has ripened to full dry hardness, there's not a moment to be lost. Take it away. Take your time, but hurry back. Bud, the younger son, is a member of the 4-H Club with a beef cattle project. During the harvest, he supervises storage of the wheat at the farm granary, where it'll be held for transshipment to the big elevators along the river. Now the hectic days of dust and heat and the clatter of machinery are at an end. The harvest is over. And all that remains are the fields of stubble, which will lie fallow for a whole year, resting and reserve energy. Of course, the farmer's wife bakes her own bread with all that wheat on the property. And here she is, Bobby Root, wife of a farmer and mother of two future farmers. She first laid eyes on her husband at Oregon State, and she hasn't taken them off of him since. She's a very important member of this wheat-growing team. Her men will tell you, the most important member. Oh, Heavenly Father, give us this day our daily bread. And accept our humble thanks for thy endless bounty. Amen. While Floyd Root prepares for next year's crop, where is this year's harvest? Moving, always moving, along the intricate and complex route to market. By truck, by train, and by barge. Moving to the flour mills of distant lands by ship, to England and the ports of Western Europe, to Japan and the still free lands of the Orient, to India and Africa and the islands beyond the sea. Wheat-eating peoples all over the world are taller, heavier, and healthier than the people who depend on rice for their basic diet.
I have to confess a personal connection to that film. It's the first time that I actually have a personal connection to a sponsored film, so I guess that's a milestone. Young Bud Root is my spouse's uncle from Yakima, Washington, taught me to watch Fox News. Something that's very little work has been done about, and there's been some work done, as far as I know, about contemporary work in the area of training media, especially videos, but there's been relatively little done in terms of training films. This is a huge genre. I've picked a clip from a film called The Inner Man Steps Out by Henry Strauss. Some of Henry's films are in Carolyn Martel's film from the other night. He was an idiosyncratic and unusual person. He was in the Merchant Marine. He was a man of the left. He made films on employee training for Pan America and the Bell System, for General Electric. He made a film for General Electric's management gospel was called Bulwerism, after a man named Lemuel Bulwer. It was considered very anti-labor, and Henry was proud to have taken GE's money and made an anti-Bulwerist film. This is a bit about, from a film advocating that managers discover their own inner man so as to better emphasize with workers. It's an extremely dramatic clip, which is, of course, why I picked it. Let's go ahead.
And it isn't just my people. It's the front office, too. I get to my desk yesterday morning. Right on top of everything, there's a nice big rush memo. What is it? A new batch of drawings for a job we spent 2 hours lining up the night before. Some bright boy up front. No reason, nothing. Just go ahead and change the whole damn job. So I see the boss. Say, Mac, did you see what those guys in engineering cooked up this time? Look at these drawings. The whole thing's changed around. I don't get it.
Jerry, I'm very busy right now.
But, Mac, this stuff has to go out tomorrow. I don't understand why it's been changed.
Jerry, you don't have to understand. I can't take the time now. You've got the plans, and the job has to get out.
But...
You don't have to understand. You don't have to understand.
So what could I do? I went out on the floor and just gave the foreman the new dope cold. Of course, they had a gripe about it, and naturally all my fault. Why didn't I go to bat? What the hell was I doing about it? So I told them to just go ahead and get the damn thing out. That's what you get paid for. Same way they treat me.
Well, maybe not, Jerry.
A bit of a cliffhanger there. The first film that's in the draft of the field guide is called A is for Adam. It's a film that came out in early on, 53-ish. It was burdened by the need to naturalize the atom and nuclear technology. It presents the atom as sort of a three-personed godlike being, God in three persons, a warrior, scientist, doctor, and industrialist. It's a John Sutherland film, the wonderful animation company that often took on projects that involved simplifying complicated ideas. Powerful interests were often involved, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Sloan Foundation, the New York Stock Exchange. They didn't work for unions. What their particular achievement was to present contentious ideas in a humorous and self-deprecating manner. And here they humanize and personalize the atom. This is a brief sequence about the periodic table. So welcome to Element Town.
But certainly not all atoms are alike. There are in nature more than 90 basic elements, which is science term for families of atoms. To scientists, the atoms of the individual atom families, or elements, are identified by number, That is, the number of protons or positive charges in their nucleus. And they vary all the way from hydrogen, which has just one proton, to oxygen with 8 protons, to gold, he's rich with 79, finally on to the heaviest of all natural elements, uranium with 92 protons. Now, within each element or family of atoms, there can be different members, each one having the same number of protons, but differing in the number of neutrons. The total of an atom's protons and neutrons is its atomic weight. Thus, in natural uranium, we have U-234, U-235, and U-238. These different members of the same element or atom family, science calls isotopes. Some elements, tin for instance, have a great many isotopes. Others, like aluminum, are lone wolves with just one. Now, most atoms of most elements are content with their lot in life. We speak of them as being stable, but others are busy day and night, being what science calls radioactive. Like radium, throwing off powerful rays along with some of its neutrons and protons, until it actually alters its own nuclear structure and changes to another family, and then to another, until it does become stable at last. This spontaneous changing of elements is called natural transmutation.
If anybody's found the artwork for Element Town, I'd love to see it. I'm a particular fan of films that were produced by the American Highway Lobby. This is one of many, many films that were produced to encourage citizens to support the legislation leading to the authorization of the interstate highway system. This is a film called Give Yourself a Green Light, produced by GM Public Relations. Films like this need to get people to sit up and pay attention. So it has lengthy policy rants, but they're interspersed or punctuated with sort of interesting sequences like this. This is a minute shot, I think, on the highway in Detroit. Please hit play.
Hey, pal, what's the do?
Just keep rooting around. Load and unload, buddy. That's what to do, like a bunch of sheep.
With 54 million vehicles on our streets and roads today, 50% more than before the war, by 1975, they say we will be driving 85 million. 5 o'clock, USA.
Ah, for the life of a traveling salesman. Late for every appointment. This is an ulcer route.
Will you stop honking, Mac? We ain't going nowhere.
This is Agony Alley. Morning rush and evening wait. Fight your way home from work. You think you got it made. Good job. Car nearly paid for. So you get a little home in the suburbs. Away from the city smoke. Out from the shadows of the factory. Into the sun and clean air. Raise a few kids, some flowers and vegetables. The big dream coming true. But it backfires into a pipe dream. Exhaust pipe dream. Every night it takes longer to get home, wasting more time and gasoline. No wonder everybody's acting so nervous. What's a citizen gonna do?
Still a pertinent question. Charles Guggenheim became a very well-known documentary maker. In 1956, when he was still working in St. Louis, made a modern-day city symphony as the annual report of the city of St. Louis to the taxpayers. This is a brief excerpt from a film called The Big City, which was praised by the New York Times as being graphic, fluent, and compact. Let's play that.
Water for the factories. water for chemicals, water for the lathes, water for the steel mills, and water for the foundries. Water for the boilers and furnaces. 8:05 in the big city. Time to fire up. The big city must live on clean water and clean air, so the air, too, becomes the responsibility of the big city. Every day, the skies are watched, the air checked. From this breathing machine, the city sees what is in the air, what the people breathe. Today, the air is safe and clean. 15 years ago, it looked like this. Our lungs looked like this. Now, at 8:15 in the morning, we can see the sunlight. And the traffic light. 8:18 in the morning, time for a change. With faces washed, dishes cleaned, and breathing the morning air, the citizen of the big city is now ready to face the world of traffic. $130,000 signs and signals, 25,000 new signs a year, 6,000 new bulbs. $1,500 miles of streets and alleys to be maintained. Nearly 3 million miles of painted lines. 23,000 gallons of paint a year.
One day I hope to see a guide to films made about the city of this type. The last clip that we have time for today is a straight consumer marketing film. It may be familiar to some of you. Once Upon a Honeymoon, made in 1956 as part of Bell Systems' campaign to sell color telephones to the population, made in Hollywood by Jerry Fairbanks. We're going to tour the Jerry Fairbanks studio tonight in the screening. The song that we're going to hear was made available as sheet music from your local telephone company business office. You could go and pick it up and sing it. So an interesting, you know, trying to take a jingle into the domain of entertainment. So our last clip is a brief excerpt from Once Upon a Honeymoon, 1956, made in Hollywood.
I wish I had a castle in the sky. Away up high where bluebirds like to fly. A cozy little castle with 100 rooms or more.
Oh dear. Someday.
With stars for windows, clouds for rugs, a rainbow for a door. I wish.
I just wish I had a decent kitchen. I wish
the faucet wouldn't drip all day. I wish that refrigerator door would close and stay closed. I wish I had a stove whose pilot light was always lit.
Furthermore, a kitchen phone at hand when friends call up to chat a bit. Hello? Hello, yes, this is Mary. How are you? Bye.
They say your kitchen dazzles every eye.
A brand new sink, a built-in oven, a new refrigerator and a phone. A kitchen phone, a bright red phone. I gotta go. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. I'll call you later. I wish my living room were all redone. New drapes, new rugs, oh, this is fun. It's nice to have a telephone to blend with my new drapes and rugs. A living room that's all our own.
Maybe Don can take that one on next. So we have the privilege of Jenny Horn and Greg Waller as respondents. Should we do it in alphabetical order? I guess by last name. Your choice. So Jennifer Horn from Bryn Mawr.
Okay. Hi. Oh. This is for you, right? The applause is for you? Hmm? Okay. Yeah, I'm Jenny Horn from Bryn Mawr College, and it's been a real honor to be a part of this project. Can't tell you how many times as I read through the draft of the field guide, I thought back to 10, 15 years ago when I started my dissertation research looking at associational film from the silent period, educational film made by the Edison Company, wishing that I had a guide of this sort, literally armed with only Gloria Waldron's book, The Information Film, which many of you know, and the Viter book, Before Video. You know, these are the texts that we tried to make use of to get us to the archives, but they were certainly, for what they were great, but they were inadequate, and I think this guide really will stimulate a lot of research. And I wanted to amplify one of the things that Don said in his comments very quickly, noting the similarity between this moment and the Brighton moment. I think that one of the wonderful things about what's going on around sponsored film and industrial and education film and, you know, what we see here at Orphans is this new connection between archives and scholars. And I think that's something that this guide really has been able to address in a very direct and wonderful way. So I just want to make, I have a very brief amount of time, but I just wanted to make a few remarks about possible opportunities that this guide raises for us as a community and in our various fields. I think one of the things that's that I wanted to borrow Craig Baldwin's principle of availabilism and say that one of the things that this project really does is it capitalizes on unavailabilism, particularly in the silent era. And I think that's one of the places that for me as a reader of the guide seemed to be you know, stimulating in the types of absences and silences that are there. So, and I'll come back to that point, hope, if we have time. But I just wanted to talk about these opportunities that I saw. One of the opportunities that's clearly in the guide, but also in this week of programming of this Orphans, is the possibility to reinvent and reinterpret these genre and category of the films from this period. And as I passed through the guide, I noted that in the descriptions, the films that are talked about are described very differently. And I'm just going to give you a quick list of the way in which these films are mentioned, advertising film, training film, advocacy film, travelogue, mental health film, corporate training film, safety film, public service film, driving safety film, institutional film, documentary film, short promotional film, high budget institutional film, high production industrial, anti-communist pro-free enterprise film, and there are anti-labor films. Some are just referred to as films, and some are referred to as shorts. And, of course, this is language that we're all familiar with, but for me it really is suggestive of the very hybrid and polymorphous categorization, both in the guide's approach to this field, but also in the field itself. And I guess one of the questions I want to raise is then, you know, the possibility we can talk about these categories and ask what the range of descriptions, what the range of descriptors used suggests to us about the film material, the material that clearly is, it's either available, it's held somewhere in an archive and that's noted in the guide, or it's unavailable. Does it suggest a range and diversity or similarity and narrowness? Does it suggest stability or instability? Do these monikers obscure possible other ways of describing these films? Some are melodramatic, some are comedic, as we've seen. Some are horrific, and that safety film certainly, the driving safety film certainly, Sixth Wheel certainly showed that. So I was hoping maybe there could be some brief discussion among us here about how the guide might also foreground form in what's represented. And I'm recalling, of course, this thought is indebted somewhat to what Oliver Gagin told us or asked us to think about yesterday in terms of influence, tradition, and convention. These are certainly things that Rick is incredibly knowledgeable about, but maybe we can help in our discussion add to that. Another opportunity that I see in the guide is the way in which this guide might help us to, obviously write new histories of cinema. And I guess that those new histories could be thought of in really inventive ways. I think looking at the field guide made me think about cross-pollination, collaboration between spheres of cinema that we have previously dealt with as quite separate. What does the relationship between documentary and sponsored film, or where is the relationship between documentary and sponsored film in terms of its production? Some of the filmmakers we've heard about today, Sam Orleans and Charles Guggenheim, I think you mentioned, these are it seems to me that there's the possibility in this guide to talk about how documentary film as a form was really dependent upon the sponsored film sphere. And I think George Stoney, who's also here, has written a little bit about that. I think the guide also suggests possibilities for thinking about theatrical, non-theatrical programming differently in providing links through the non-filmic citations in the guide. I think that the questions of exhibition are very clear as clearly marked out as new areas for research that this guide is suggesting. It certainly charts a much more vast distribution situation than has previously been written about. And I think also most importantly, looking at the guide provides the opportunity to fill in gaps in terms of archival collections. What do we have? What do we have to look at? Where can we suggest our students go to do new research? I would love to see the field guide used in this way. And I want to bring up another opportunity very quickly that for me the guide has a question that the guide raises for me, and that's right in the title, institutional and industrial. I would like to ask the question, what does institutional have to do with industrial? For me, originally, I thought that was just sort of a group. That's a genre. Those are together. But clearly, in hearing more about what types of agencies, bureaus, organizations constitute institutional film, it seems to me you have the twinning of potentially opposed spheres of reception, opposed spheres of production. And that seems to me to be something that is a possible opposition that the guide could actually amplify, draw out, and present as a kind of contradiction. You have films made for the benefit of promoting unchallenged capitalism on the one hand, but you have films of benevolence, films of public health on the other hand. And these are together in one guide. And for me, that sort of situation of those two spheres in one guide really is suggestive and suggestive of a contradiction, and a contradiction that might find its way into our analysis of the film form. I think, given the time, I'll leave it at that, but and turn the next response over to Craig Waller.
Thanks. I'll keep it real brief, and I did want to talk on the aesthetic value of parsley, but Don covered that. That's what I was thinking of in particular. I mean, I came to the project, and again, I'll repeat what people have said. This is kind of a project love fest here, but nonetheless, it's a terrific project to even be partially involved with. It seems to me extraordinarily important. I came to it much different, I think, than the collectors or archivists or fans. I was doing a lot of research on the social history of film exhibition in the United States with some suspicion that there was a bigger story than movie theaters, and that even the story of movie theaters and the movies in the United States was bigger than had been assumed. And plowing through newspaper after newspaper, doing a local history of places in Kentucky, for example, I kept finding films that weren't fitting, that would clearly be films of the sort in this guide. A Buster Brown movie shown on a sheet in 1903 outside a shoe store, YMCA missionary films being shown in 1907, a Lexington, Kentucky school taking its whole class to a movie theater to see a public safety movie in 1914 and thereby authorizing the movie theater to some degree. And it continued as I began working more on the 1930s, when in fact movie theaters were closing by the droves. And as I looked at some small rural communities really hard hit by the Depression, what I was finding in weekly and daily newspapers for small rural counties was, in fact, a really thriving American cinema, a presence of American movies in everyday life that was to be measured not only by what was in the movie theater, but by the fact that for example, the Fish and Game Administration was showing movies on Main Street, or that traveling missionary societies were regularly putting on films in the churches in the area, and especially that there were tractor movies, as I've come to call them, farm films being shown everywhere free in stores and tractor agencies, that Chevy had mobile operators roaming the countryside of rural Kentucky. And that created for me this this really strong sense that one of the key parts of a project like this, I mean, it seems to me extraordinarily fascinating material. It's fascinating in the sense of its surreal qualities. It's fascinating because it shows the constant construction and reimagining of business in America, of how capital moved over the century, of the public sphere, of what that world looked like out there, and of the national, and even those constant images of the globe that you see in this. Those are all extraordinary aspects, and the movies are entertaining, as I've come to learn at Orphans and Orphans and Orphans over the years. They're always the high points of the screenings at Orphans. It seems to me that there's a really deep and abiding interest in importance in this guide and this type of material at the exhibition end as well, and a way to think about that is through those films. And the exhibition end, I think, is going to open up a bigger historical project, as Jennifer said, that really is a new history of American cinema, a much broader history of American cinema, within which these types of films will have a crucial role. In a real practical sense, the question for me is how to get the movies from researchers, and not just from archives to researchers, and from archives to programmers, which also seems to me very important, and this conference demonstrates that, the value of that again and again, But in fact, how do you get these movies back to the classroom is an interesting issue to my mind. Like, what do we do with them to get them back to the classroom? And I think a field guide like this can be a real crucial intervention in an academic environment. I know in my case at Indiana, they're known for having one of the strongest instructional support service resource areas in the country producing films. They kept 16. They went and picked up 16 films when Illinois was dumping them, and they have a warehouse full of them. And in fact, to get any of those things, even access to those things, much less get them saved or restored, it's going to require some kind of institutional intervention that this guide suggests. It seems to me really important in that regard, and I appreciate the practical benefits to me that I'm going to have with the guide in hand. When I looked at the preliminary text for the field guide, I had a couple suggestions. I thought about it, probably not surprisingly, as a document in constructing film history and as a historical document, and it seemed to me a fascinating, impossible but fascinating task to try to come up with this list, and not only to move across genres, but I was struck by what kinds of questions this does raise. Do we think that there's a difference between institutional, right, and commercially sponsored? Do we count state, federal, local government-sponsored material as part of this group? How about church-sponsored material, like the missionary films I've mentioned? The original list, quite understandably, had an MGM film as part of it, and I didn't think that was a mistake as much as the problem of defining the difficulty of putting fine bounds around it. That was one point that struck me. The second was, and this was a recommendation I made in part in responding to the draft, is, and I think it's quite different than Wendy's, great sense that there are archival sources where you could find more information than you could possibly use about a given film. My question has always been where to look for documentation. What sort of public record can we find of these films? What sort of ads, not only in a place like Educational Screen or Business Screen for that matter, but in the moving picture world or trade magazines or local newspapers, traces of their existence in the world? And part of my encouragement when I read the guide was to incorporate that material as much as possible into the annotations so that, in fact, from the outset, people could not ignore the circulation and recirculation of these films in the world as part of their crucial history and identity. And finally, that was, I think, the main suggestion that I had, and I think it's built into the guide, and I think it's a really crucial one, that production history is important as much as we can find. But it seems to me the interesting question about these and about, in fact, more broadly about film, and especially if we're thinking about these films and their infiltration of everyday life way beyond the movie theater, then it seems to me the question really is about how much can we know about how these things were exhibited? How were they distributed? How much difference did it make in the 1930s with the proliferation of 16? What was the circulation and recirculation of these films that this last iteration continues the process so dramatically and so interestingly? So I want to really thank Rick and everybody else for this extraordinary project and thank them for letting me just be a little part of it.